Jaden Lipkins, student representative, is no longer on the board. He's been sent notice because he hasn't attended classes or been enrolled for more than the 6 months that's allowed. So a new one will be provided. The student association has been asked to provide one. And Mr. Suguchi has retired from the board, so he will not be here. And in terms of other things, I did send a letter to those who have been still attending to the board, so only two of them, and remind them that it is important to be on to the board meetings.
Thank you.
Because otherwise we can't do our business, but if we don't have a quorum, we can't do our business, and in the event that a lot of people don't attend, we'll be in the position to ask them for repeating things that were said before that were not known to someone. Wasn't here very long, so we try to encourage attendance by both positive and negative means. Another thing I would comment on that Nancy, Dan, and I spoke with the, well, we appeared before, the Board of Trustees, and Nancy reviewed the annual report. She spent time doing that. And I made three comments about what we're doing or what we had done. I talked about our continued evolution in bond expenditure oversight, making eye contact with him. And you'll notice that if we do actually accomplish our agenda as we plan to do it, 1 hour will be spent on the field of the use of discretion funds. I talked about the fact that it's a part of this process. We're going to hear about the top five problems, so we're going to hear about what the status is and what's being done to solve them. Talked about the fact that we meet in a way that is not synchronous with the Board of Trustees. They meet more frequently than we do. And while we would like to have the opportunity to comment in advance of all motions being considered to provide our advice to the Board of Trustees, we will continue, given the lack of synchronization, in some cases, to provide our comments after the Board of Trustees have considered the motion. And I also mentioned the fact that we have decided to make a decision not to request a standing in the council, but rather the ability to seek one if we felt we need it. So those are those things. Are there any public speakers at this meeting? Good, we may schedule that. Anybody wants to move for the approval of the minutes?
Second.
Any discussion?
Who moved?
You. I seconded. Okay.
I'll call, there's no discussion, so I'll call the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
I'll give it to you.
All those who are not voting?
Aye.
Vote? So one of those.
Okay. Mr. Ambrose abstained.
Okay. From the minutes?
Yes. If I could, just to, for clarity's sake, because we do have a recorder, but it would be very helpful when a motion is made and seconded if you would tell us who made the motion, who seconded the motion, and if there were any abstentions. That'll come out on the recording, but it's very difficult for us to recognize the voice if somebody's being captured.
So Thomas Smith moved, Dan Schwartz seconded.
Right.
Okay, have one abstention, the one to announce.
Correct. Thank you.
So we have the next subject is two audits we're going to hear. Well, actually, one audit from KPMG touching on financial and performance. That's an interesting distinction. So we'll begin your audit and make that distinction for us.
I will. And thank you for having us. My name is Tracy Hensley. I'm the engagement partner on both audits, which I'll explain in a minute. Erica Albert, the director in our construction advisory program, is with us today, as well as Pat Starr, a manager of that practice. Proposition 39 of California requires those who receive proceeds from that proposition, which you do, to have two separate audits. One is an audit of bond expenditures, an actual financial statement, which you have in front of you, and I'm going to walk through some high-level comments on that. And the second thing they require you to do is to have a performance audit, effectiveness, efficiency of the program itself.
What are the notes that you have in that?
I will go over those. I'll talk about all of this.
Distinct from financial.
Distinct from financial, although we do touch expenditures when we're looking at that to make sure they're in compliance. So there is a crossover, which is why it's helpful that we do both sides of it. We did experience some efficiencies there. So first I'll talk to you about the bond expenditure audit. I have two different agendas here. This one says bond audit in front of it, and there is a report. This is bond construction program, Proposition A, Proposition AA, Measure J. Those are financial statements prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And that was the scope of our audit, was to provide an audit and an opinion on that financial statement that's included. There are supplemental schedules in that report that we do not give an opinion on. They're cumulative in nature. Adjustments have been made for various reasons that are reasonable and understandable. We give an opinion on that very first page that shows how much the expenditure for each bond program was for the year end of June 30th, 2012. Total expenditures were approximately $400 million for those combined measures. And we issued our report on the date of December 19th. So we're very pleased that we issued that.
Thanks, Mom.
Right on time this year. So when we're auditing those financial statements, certainly we are trying to make sure that those expenditures are recorded in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, that the projects and the expenditures made are on the project lists that are attached to the bond measures, and that those amounts are reconciled to the financial statements, then the expenditures are in accordance with the cost principles of the district, and those that are allowed under Prop 39. So we do touch expenditures if we required communication. I'm not going to go through all of that. We went through that with the audit committee and also the board. That is for governing boards and financial statements. I'm not sure we'd be very interested in that, other than to say we did not have any material disagreements or difficulties working with management. All books and records were made available to us, etc. We did have some...
Are the various systems within the district accounting systems that are tracking expenditures for building finally talking to each other better than they used to? For a while, there was, I know we went through this with Bandy Camp. There were funds being expended from under a one accounting system from various accounts that were not easily tied back. The IG had to go through and sort of manually do that. Are those systems sort of in one place now so that you really know where things are?
No. There are still many manual processes that occur. But I will point out that when it comes to routine transactions, those seem to be perfectly answered. Those that are recorded on the build side are properly captured on the district books. Those are easy to write. If there are unusual, out of the ordinary transactions, corrections, issues that come up, that seems to be where a lot of the reconciliation that you're speaking of comes up. And I think that's probably consistent because there are a lot of manual processes in place.
Are we trying to fix that, or are we just decided to live with that?
That's a question.
It's being fixed. It's something that we're working on. Something that we noticed, I think this was earlier on, obviously, was that initially, it was believed that the reconciliation was an annual thing that they would go on, and that was when a lot of the mistakes were found, where the books were not talking to each other. So currently, the program and the CFO's office are working on a more of a monthly basis to reconcile anything and even capture any outstanding transactions that wouldn't have been naturally captured or caught in between that. Would that be an accurate statement?
Is that still done manually?
Yes.
There are right.
If an account were missing from all the sets of documents you look at and reconcile, you have no way of detecting it?
Sure. We have audit procedures that would assist us in doing that.
I'm going to do it. Every piece of data that you have lacks a particular piece. They all lack them in common. What is it? What you seem to be doing is reconciling documents. How would you find that?
Some of the adjustments that we've identified this year in this process is exactly what you're talking about. And we do a search for unrecorded liabilities that may have occurred at the subsequent to year end. Mm-hmm. And because this is as of June 30th and we issued December 19th, we actually look at expenditures all the way from June to December 19th.
So what you're saying is all the pieces of evidence will appear if you look at enough records?
I don't want to say all, because we do sample and we do have thresholds. So if it's material, we believe our audit procedures are sufficient to identify that. If there is some collusion, some fraud, which we have no knowledge of, then, of course, that may go undetected. But we do have procedures to get comfortable that it is complete and accurate. I don't have a percentage, but I can tell you that we looked at 972 separate expenditures totaling in excess of 200
million. If there were a thousand, you'd say, boy, that's really a complete sample.
Yeah.
If there were a million, I'd say, you haven't touched anything. So that's
I think 972, frankly, was a little too much.
But out of 200, that's 200 million
dollars. That was approximately $200 million or more. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I just remember the 972 sticking in my mind, and I'm sure Jim and his team remember that as well.
Then about $400 million this year, so.
This year was a little over $440 million, I believe.
Yeah, so we're about half.
So that, right. That was just one side of it, right? That was just for the financial statements, so we can give an opinion as to whether they're fairly stated, reasonably stated.
Okay.
So what is our conclusion? Our conclusion is that they are fairly stated. We need an unqualified opinion on each of the three financial statements.
The highest category?
Yes, that's as good as it gets. Clean opinion is what you would call that. Some people say, well, why don't you call it qualified? It's qualified. Well, qualified is a bad thing. We don't want it to be qualified. That means it's an except for. It's okay except for these things. It's unqualified. You believe it really presents its vision.
Would you speak up?
Wow, nobody's ever told me that before. Yes.
I might have to stand up, I think.
Shall I?
It might be easier to echo when you're down.
So that is the result of our opinion on the financial statements. We also did identify issues that we felt management could continue to work on and correct. One you already mentioned. And that was really the biggest issue, the coordination and the reconciliation between Bill's records and the district's records. And again, it wasn't routine items that they had difficulty with. It was the big, out-of-the-ordinary, unusual items that really caused a lot of time to reflect on, fix, and present in the financial statements. So we did, again, issue a material weakness on that process. However, along the way, we found lots of improvements. So,
improvements from the prior year?
Yes.
Okay. How long? You found no problems this year at all?
Oh, no. We had a material weakness in internal control.
Okay.
Over just the topic that you mentioned earlier, the reconciliation, the timing of it. At the end of the day, is it right? Yes. The process that went to get there, controls could have been better.
How long has KPMG been doing this?
This is the second year. I'm sorry. Well, that's complicated. Because for 3 years, you believed you did not need one, which you did. You believed you did not need one. Last year, not the year I'm referring to, the year before, it came to the district, you did need to do a financial statement on it. We had done prior, so not this year, but last year, we did 3 years' worth of audits.
Okay.
So I don't know how to answer that question. This is about the fourth audit.
Perfect.
Yeah, this is about the fourth audit we've done in a period of 18 months on the bond expenditures.
I do have a follow-up question. You did mention earlier that you really can't uncover fraud and all that sort of thing. Which personally, I think a lot of us, that's what we're really concerned about. So you're not even able to report that. Possibilities of fraud, is there any way of doing a three-dimensional monetary analysis to see if there's some kind of shrinkage? Someplace to be there.
So, we're not responsible for auditing for fraud. We're not responsible for looking for it, ferreting it out in this process. We are to give an opinion on the financial statements. However, we do have discussions with major process owners, all of them, the Chancellor, Jim, Tom, your internal auditor, your OIG, everybody we could find. To have conversations about whether there are fraud risk factors that we should address and that might cause us to alter our audit approach to address those fraud risk factors. So we do address the possibility that there may be fraud by having discussions. Sometimes things come to our attention, not here, but in other instances things come to our attention, and we are required to follow up, but it's not a fraud audit.
No, I have two follow-up questions now. In that group of people you talked to, you did talk to the IG and her staff to see if they had anything, smelled anything that you could look into. And the second thing is, should we be hiring a more advanced audit that would include this fraud element that that has not been ordered. I mean, the fact that we didn't order an audit for 3 years itself has me concerned. But
you did do the catch-ups.
Yeah, so should there be an audit that includes fraud hired from your firm?
You know, generally when anybody asks me those kinds of questions, I always say, is there something specific you have a concern about? Otherwise, it's a free-for-all, and, you're spending
more money.
It's billions of dollars we're concerned about. That's what our job is here.
So maybe I should move to the performance audit, because that's probably where that comes more into play.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm looking at the conclusion of this, and it says we identified 6 program areas with opportunities for improvement. I assume those are all in here that I want to see.
So that's the performance audit.
That's the performance audit.
So the one that I'm speaking about right now, which I'm just about ready to complete, because it sounds like you want to get to the next one, is this other report that you're working on.
Okay, just a little bit
of a guess.
It's kind of got a gray cover.
Yeah,
grayish cover. Yeah, there you go. So, if you want to see the actual comment that we wrote on our consideration of internal control in the connection with the financial statement audit, that would be on page 8 of the one that kind of has a grayish cover. And that's where we discuss better coordination, better reconciliations, non-routine items need to be better addressed, maybe more frequently. Maybe the district needs a dedicated professional just focusing on this area because it's so significant to the district. That was the point you made. It's a $6 billion program that spends almost $500 million a year. The district really should have a dedicated person working on this daily. And so,
what are the differences?
Reconciling, making sure they understand all the transactions, making sure they're reconciling up from the good side. Because another focus of our audit of the bond program statement is to make sure that it's the same thing that's reported on the financial statements of the district. And that took a lot longer than it should have. That all of that should have been known. If we had not come in, there would have been errors in the financial statements. And any time your auditor acts as a part of your internal control, you have a weakness in internal control. So that comment is laid out on page 8 and the following pages.
So what's the plan of action by the district to do that? Is it a permanent person, full-time, in the works?
Yes.
There'll
be a liaison. There'll be 2 people acting as liaison between the CFO's office and the program manager.
That will be doing that function solely?
Yeah.
So you have 2 people coming on to do that. Does that address your concerns as an auditor?
I'm sorry.
So he's bringing on, the district says they're bringing on 2 people.
Double.
And you're communicating well in that kind of people she says should be coming on, all the kind of people.
This is out of the CFO's office. It'll be running out of the CFO's office to be liaisons with the program manager team.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a question in your framework that I think people have been asking, but perhaps too specifically. You are guided in a lot of what you do by generally accepted practice, right?
Yes. Auditing standards and accounting principles.
The accountants refuse. The question is this. If you look at your generally accepted accounting principles, is there anything other than what we just addressed, which is being addressed by college, that is lacking in terms of the functions you provide? It could be frequency of audit, it could be quality of audit. Is there anything from the point of view of what's generally accepted as good that, all things considered, including the change being made, is not being done?
That's a great segue to the performance audit, and yes, I do have a comment on that. I think Jim is going to address this. I've spoken to the chancellor about it. One of the reasons I do think there is something that can be done is, what's the date today? It's February 22nd. We were engaged to audit this as of June 30th, 2012. So you are hearing 6 months after the year end what our comments and conclusions and recommendations are. Many organizations that have a bond program of this size have a much more frequent audit review, whether it's internal, whether it's external. monthly, daily, somebody sampling frequently to catch errors as they occur that are part of your internal control, or maybe not, maybe independent.
So what's your response? Do you have a response to that question?
Yeah.
The response being, do you think a monthly would be appropriate? And by the way, I'm not suggesting a monthly presentation to the board. I'm talking about internal.
No, I don't think it's monthly at all. I think it's continuous. I mean, it's constant. So with any, when you run an organization, if you look at it.
Let me rephrase it. I know where you're going, and it isn't what I meant. You picked up on something I didn't mean to say. I said it probably. Of course, if you have an employee, it's a continuous practice. But that's what that person does as an employee. The question is when or how frequently the results of that employee's work, who's looking into these irregularities, is presented to senior management.
Ideally, it would be presented on a regular basis. That's dependent upon the frequency of the audits. What's envisioned for the future with the quality team, which is also an audit team, is you go in, do random samplings, not only of the financial records, but also of the processes, to ensure that we're following standard operating procedures and that people are functioning as they are. Then if any non-compliances are noted, they are elevated to senior management immediately, in which time the folks who have committed the non-compliance, if you will, are given an opportunity to rectify that and to fix it. Then there's a circle of going back, re-auditing to ensure that it's complete. This is a totally different function and team that will be doing this.
They will not be auditing themselves.
Pardon me?
You're saying that they will not be auditing themselves.
No. This is outside of the folks who actually handle the money. So you'll have separate functions. These folks will be looking a lot at the PM level and at my level to make sure you don't want the fox watching the hen house.
Right.
And then at the other level, I'll be monitoring all of the campuses, so the 9 different campuses where the money really is.
And what I think I heard you say is the following. You have some notion of a threshold. The problem is serious. It gets above that threshold. When it gets above that threshold, your team is notified.
Absolutely. And to be quite frank, if somebody's filing system is not part of the standard operating procedures, I don't necessarily need to issue non-compliance and go out there. They just need to fix it. If something looks strange with regards to how they're accounting for their estimates at completion, that's unacceptable. Because we have a standardized procedure, in which case, and how you fill it out, and that becomes a big red light. And that's something that I want to see to ensure that the accounting system, so that all those reports that you read, mm-hmm. there's always transparency there. And so everybody's doing the reporting out the same way, and there's no money squirreled away here for this project where they don't want to show, red numbers because they don't have enough money to finish their program. That all has to be checked and audited on a regular basis, mm-hmm. monthly basis.
You made a statement, I believe, that you said, this annual audit, which we are currently doing, is not as frequent as other bond programs of this size.
Oh, not in setup. Okay. The annual is generally the same timing.
So,
but my point too is that whatever comments we had in the performance audit, which we haven't yet addressed yet, were as of a June 30th, 2012 date. So what the district and Bill have done between then, we may have touched on briefly, but we haven't audited, we haven't examined, we didn't verify because we weren't engaged to do that. The actual timing is actually very similar to most organizations because of the size of it. So while you're required to have this, what Jim is suggesting is that this will be a much smaller report. At the end of the year, when we come out to do a performance audit, which you're required to have by law, they are managing it along with.
Why don't we let you do your performance audit thing before we start asking you all your questions on performance audit?
No, it's fine.
Elliot, I have one last question for Jim, just to clarify something you're going. These internal auditors, are they auditing the completion of each project, going through each project prior to disbursement of final monies?
That would be part of the audit. And that's just one part of it.
That's one of
it. Yes, sir. Good.
And if I may go on to what our scope of the performance audit is, those may be things that you're going to cover, and so you can elaborate if you like. So again, the financial statement audit I just discussed, that's historical. That's just what happened. That's what you spent the money on. It all seemed to be in accordance with the law and your own rules. So we'll move on to the performance audit. And the performance audit has a different objective. It does have the same year-end auditing, though. That's June 30th, 2012. But the difference is an objective of performance audit is to identify opportunities for program improvement, effectiveness, efficiency of the things that you do. So we do a performance audit for these same measures that I mentioned earlier, AAA and Measure J. Those expenditures totaled $429 million. So what was the scope? What did we actually look at? And this was in the request for proposal. We did what the district asked us to do. One, we looked at general bond program policies and procedures. We looked at budget and the budget transfer process. We looked at the procurement process. We looked at the change order and field order process. We looked at the project scheduling process, closeout procedures and documentation process. And then we did, again, sample bond expenditures, actually picked them, made sure they were approved in accordance with the cost principles, et cetera. And we were able to, as I mentioned, cross a little bit over to the bond expenditure audit so that we could save a little bit of time. As you know, this is a three-year engagement that we're on. Last year, we looked at several campuses. This year, we looked at some. Next year, we'll look at the remainder. This year, we visited Los Angeles City College, East Los Angeles College, LA Trade Tech, and the district headquarter building project that occurred here. You can see the projects that we performed. The district receives lots of reports, as you know, as they have over the last several years. Our report, and I can't recall what page it's on, refers to many changes, initiatives, improvements that Bill and the district have made in the performance, in the expenditure of bond proceeds, I should say. And so I'm just going to point a few out, not to say we still didn't have comments on them, but we did see some improvements in these areas. One is a strengthened budget transfer process as of October 2011, which was already several months into our year end. And when we go through the comments, and I'm going to have Erica do that. By the way, Erica is an engineer and a CPA, so interesting combination. I'm going to have her go through that. But it's important to keep in mind that last year when we were engaged to do the audit, we didn't make this presentation until, I believe, close to your year end that you were here auditing.
December, wasn't it?
It was late because we were engaged late. So, yes, there will be repeat comments because some of these things weren't even known as this year was progressing. So I want to make sure that is understood. One of our recommendations, which they have adopted, is to create a centralized schedule system and an individual who is dedicated to that function that occurred in August of last year. Probably one of the largest things, probably something that Jim and the rest of his team is happy about, is reorganizing the reporting structure of CPMs, which just occurred in September 2012. And then a program-wide risk assessment was performed where areas were identified to establish a district-wide reserve. So as of January 18th, we issued our report, and we had observations and recommendations. Various priorities, and again, Erica, I'm going to let you go over what those are and answer all of our questions.
Oh, great. All right. Thanks, everyone. So my name is Erica Alward. I've worked with Jim's team and to help us answer our questions as we went through this year's audit field work, and Pam Stowers is our manager who was assisting in the field as well. And like Tracy said, our last year's report was issued in May. It covered the prior year under audit. Now this year's report covers and ends as of June 30th, 2012. So you only really have a month, in all fairness, from last year's report that came out, that any changes would have been implemented. So you will see, as a result of timing, I would say a lot of these findings would be from last year, which I would be talking about. Again, a performance audit is really focused on processes, procedures, what can be done better. And we use standard industry practices a lot of times and look at what our other clients are doing, what can be done to improve things the way they're done here. And we really look and hope, and Jim, it is great to work with because he really realizes that we come with a lot of information and a lot of things that we've seen work elsewhere. And we're here to provide those and share those observations. What can we do to make things work more? And at the end of the day, hopefully get a little more for bang for the buck, which is really the purpose of the performance audit. There has been a lot of things that we've noted that have been improved or are in the works since last year, so Tracy mentioned a few of them. A big thing for us are the policies and procedures. We did not include that as an observation in this year's report. We included that in last year's, but we do believe, and I know Jim's team is definitely working on that, that to have a really good set of policies and procedures on how things are done without being overly prescriptive is really going to assist this program and lending itself to some consistencies between the campuses on how things are done. Anything from change order to budgeting and reporting costs against those budgets. So there's just several things as an example that we talked about, and that's in last year's report that's complete progress. So we think that that's one important cornerstone. You will see that a lot of our observations revolve under around a common theme, and that's documentation. As auditors, a lot of our evidence is based on what we see in a piece of paper. If that piece of paper doesn't exist, then someone tells us, well, here how it was done. We cannot necessarily conclude that it was or it wasn't done that certain way. So you'll see that maybe some of our recommendations here revolve, and you know what, we got to keep that documentation, whether it's around procurement or budgeting or all those assumptions and underlying thoughts that led to something that is important.
Could I summarize that by saying
sure.
The judging process is based on the output of the products?
Absolutely. And, you know, everybody knows that with the instruction, you know, the cost, the schedule, and quality are complete cornerstones, and cost is measured against the budget, and that's our first priority item. Yes, I'm segueing into our first priority item, which is a repeat finding from last year. We looked at the original budget, the current budget, and then also how budgets are being changed. But there's a lot of change, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But we want to make sure that we see, to see why things are changing, how they're being changed, and then, of course, we look at the cost side and see how the costs are being tracked against budget. And that's important because you want to be able to measure yourself like a program. How well are we doing? What's our performance indicators? And one thing I think that was lacking before, which I know Jim is working towards, are, well, how are we going to measure ourselves? What are those key performance indicators? And obviously, a lot of programs, a lot of projects, you want to measure costs against your budget. Of course, that variance or that measurement doesn't mean anything unless your original budget, a baseline budget, is based upon reasonable assumptions that can be explained, right? Then you can really measure yourself. Because if your original budget wasn't meaningful, had any thoughts to begin with, or maybe it was for a building based on a just square foot dollars, for example, then you know that that's not a very good baseline. You will refine and then change that budget as things become known. And that's okay, but those assumptions and that process is what, as auditors, we'd like to follow. And our first observation really, as you read the report, tells you that we weren't able to see that. We weren't able to see what were those assumptions, what were people thinking, and what does this measurement with actual compared to the budget, what does that mean? Is it good or bad?
Inherent in this data construction. Yeah. The regular plans, the change in plans, and so on. There is data you can look at now, but it wasn't in the past.
Right. And I will say that if you look at the most recent baseline and going forward, I think you will be able to do that. But that's right now, and I know that the budget transfer process in this current year has changed as far as documentation goes. And again, we're not saying that any of the budgets were bad or poor or not thought through well enough. We just could not see how one thing changed to being a new number. What could interview people? Absolutely. But again, as auditors, I can get some comfort in that. I don't know if you're telling me what I should do. Oh yeah, of course we did this and this. We did get a lot of those things. But if we say show me, you're telling me you have good thought out assumptions.
It's just the reports they may have had that you didn't see that could only be elicited by asking questions like this.
Right. Yeah. No, but we've asked those questions.
Did we ask you about questions?
We'll send you a sample. You don't know how many questions you should have asked.
What is our a lot of the campuses are going through a remaster plan again, which means we're starting from scratch in a lot of ways in terms of we've got a pile of money left,
yes,
and we have a wish list of buildings we'd like to do, so the budgeting process is really important. What is our budgeting process to determine which buildings we should put into spending mode? We assume we have an estimating group.
Yes.
And how comfortable did you feel with that estimating group to give us numbers that eventually turn into a real thing?
Well, we didn't look at the whole picture. We looked at our sample size, too.
Within that sample size?
Yeah, within that sample size, we looked at estimated cost to completion for one thing. You know, are you going to, you know, these numbers that are being presented that are compiled primarily by the CPMs, how do we know it's not going to cost more at the end of the day?
Well, from your professional background, there is two reserve systems that are being used now to make sure that there's money left for the program, that there's enough money left to build the programs they plan to build in the face of contingencies. And so contingency funds, did you look at that and reach a conclusion as to whether or not the reserves that are now in place are likely to be adequate?
No, because that wasn't part of the scope, so I'm going to say that's the short answer. Another answer is we looked at those particular projects estimated on cost to completion based on our audit period. For that particular audit period, since it's in the past, there wasn't any record keeping because the system right now only keeps track of the most current estimate of cost to completion. So for that particular
time, there are records in your files, right, where prior estimates were.
Of the baselines, yes, I believe there is. And I can't speak to that, Todd. I mean, part of what you're seeing here is the result of a decentralized organization.
Which existed before, but even so.
So every campus was responsible for their master plans, for their baselines, for their budgeting,
but even,
for putting
even
these things together.
There was a central repository, was there not?
Of where all the old baselines came from. Right. Todd, can you answer the question?
Yeah, as far as iterations and reports, those are archived.
At the next point in time, this is the plan for...
As far as the established budgets for a set time period, I can speak back to 2007 when URS initiated. Just a comment on the first part of the budget finding. The finding, and correct me if I'm wrong, has to do with the original budget establishment at the initiation of that bond measure, right? So A, AA, and J.
There are three parts to our first finding.
Good.
First has to do with the original budget.
For the establishment, which is where you're starting. So that's A in 2001, AA in 2002, and J in 2008. Again, can't really speak to 2001, 2002, but in 2008, that was subsequent to the decentralization that Jim had mentioned. And those establishments are based on the education master plan and subsequent facilities master plan update on those campuses. So I think it was in the field where you attempted to establish that documentation. There's a subsequent comment that you touched on, which I think is your next finding, that budget rebaseline, which we're saying occurred in October of 2011. And that gives you, like we said, that gives you the baseline to measure and control changes from those budgets. That was a function of the trend toward centralization to be able to centrally control budget movements throughout the district as opposed to manage locally. So where we can give reporting and centrally report on deviations from that as opposed to just re-baselining any time there's a modification of project.
Now, this is
October 2011.
It seems like... It's interesting to go back to 2001, but I'm not getting relevant. What I'm concerned about going forward is you've now got four and a half years left to spend, but we're now spending the more difficult dollars because we're going to run out. And we established, subsequent to this audit, a much bigger reserve. We stopped all the last board meeting. We got rid of all of the satellite campuses and we put that money back into reserve accounts so we can breathe a little bit easier. But with all this new master planning going on at all the campuses after the moratorium, to me it's almost like this is day one again. And it would be nice to know that as we go through the planning process, which costs money, especially if we start putting buildings into A&E, that our budgeting process, internal budgeting process, or whatever consultants we use to do budgeting, is pretty accurate so that if we have $100 million left to spend at a campus, we pick three projects that we adequately budget at $100 million and not three projects that we misbudget that we have at $150. Spend a whole lot of money on that and then find a few of them.
And Dan, what we're doing now, and I think it's an improvement, and I'm not even sure you folks are aware of the process we put into place. We do pre-project approvals, if you will. So So a campus would have to bring, if they were going to move forward with a camp, with the project, prior to even being allowed to get it off of the dime, they need to bring it to us, show us the EACs. We have to run all the money in the budget through to ensure that the money's actually going to be there, that they're not making commitments that they can't cash a check for. And in addition to that, we then study the strategy in which they plan to attain the project, look at what the master plan is, that it complies with it, and see that it's the smartest way to spend the money. And while we don't necessarily control the college's money, we can certainly exert some opinion on what the wisest way to spend those dollars are at this point.
There's one mechanism I've just commented on the tail of that is the estimated completion exercise and the discipline applied to that in the budgeting process. So what it is looking at the in-process projects and establishing a realistic and not conservative but responsible cost at the completion of that project. And that drove a lot of the budget establishment, and now we're tracking against that. I wouldn't want to overstate the amount of reprogramming or remaster planning that's going on, but over the last year, there's definitely been a revalidation based on a lot of input about the maintainability cost and the projections for reimbursement from the state about the student loading.
And so I'm just reading these reports, and a lot of them refer to projects that are on hold until master planning is redone. So, and I realize that this is a budgeting time where people are now spending the last dollar. So you got to decide, what do I really want? Because it ain't going to all happen. So I'm not panicking. It's just that we're now starting to spend money that is going to come to an end. And I want to make sure that each campus, when they budget, and I like what you just said, Jim, they look at it and they say, I can't start this project because we don't have money to do it.
We've even taken it to a different level in some projects. For instance, the energy program, we formed an energy ad hoc with three of the board members and with some other industry experts, in which we're not even moving forward with the energy projects until they pass through that board to see that we're spending the energy money wisely that's left. So it's a greater oversight. I'm sure you're familiar with. You've got a big pot of money you can spend and buy, and even if there's a mistake in what you've done, you can take care of it. Now we're down to the point where our EACs are actively reflecting the risk associated with every project.
And consistent with the reserves you put aside for them.
Yes, sir. And on that project, we're insisting that the colleges and campuses carry the realistic figures of what it's actually going to cost to complete that project. Not necessarily, I think, I don't want to make this be too facetious here, but I think in the past it was always, we don't have enough money to finish just this, and we'll take it out of the budget for this, and never really accounting for the realistic costs associated with that specific project and the money that was budgeted with it and what the actual versus the baseline was. So we're trying to bring some ownership and some accountability back into those budgeting practices. And I'm sorry, I know
that's really, this is a really good debatable topic, and really I would say that the budget is probably the one that does deserve the most discussion. So, but I know that Duke Group is moving in the right direction for sure, and we, again, this coming audit year, we're hoping to do things concurrently, so we're not waiting till 6 months after the audit year is closed. Report even another 6 months later.
Next year, when you stand in front of us, I would like even more thorough discussion from your side as to what you've seen over the last year about how good we're getting at doing that.
Yeah, and we can all have discussion on what should our audit scope be, and that's actually my next meeting with Jim to make sure, does it make sense to focus on these areas next year's
audit. I'd like to suggest, in addition to your audit scope, it goes as follows. We now have this continuous school working on and tracking things that work for you.
It's not in place yet.
Well, it soon will be in place. Certainly between now and the next report, it should be in place. And they will raise problems when they hit a threshold of some kind. It will come to your attention or your staff's attention or something like that. But it seems to me that you're counting on that to improve the performance of your organization.
Yes, sir.
And I think, therefore, it will be a very important topic for next year to look at that internal mechanism as part of the performance audit.
Yeah, and hopefully their jobs are going to be extremely boring next year. I hope they're supposed to be even more.
And actually, we're actually in the middle of our audit year. So.
Yeah.
Some years past, we had a contractor, I won't mention the name, who was paid $1 million for a project on one of the campuses that they never started in order to complete. And it went to litigation. Are the systems, both I'll call it macro and micro, in place to make sure that that possibility has been eliminated?
Well, that sounds like fraud. You know, the expenditures were made and work wasn't done.
Right.
I'm sorry, well, Bob. I can't speak to it. Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that.
Right. Oh, and it could depend.
This is the FTR case, which was a legal matter. Oh, thank you.
In the case of this, it was through a change order process. The change order process, as you know, depending on the level, is approved starting at the CPM's office and then all the way to the gym's office. I think, though, that there isn't a systems control of those types of things that you would catch for a system, but the controls that Jim is planning on, and part of them being the resolution that allows the new program manager to have more direct control over the CPMs, you're going to start to see some of those things, the controls in place that can prevent that in the future. And along with also a lot of the things that were written into the scope of work for the new program manager as well, are going to also help that align with, because they're going to be able to do a lot of the internal audits and the internal controls to make sure that there's checks and balances built into the scope of work. So you're going to have that added layer to kind of protect.
Well, will that include physical auditing?
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay.
Yes.
This is very hard to conceive, to create $1 million worth of construction when it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of my question. Is there better communication between the physical inspection people, whoever they are, and the people that write the checks? Is there communication to know now that, you know, has it been done? Yes, it's finished. I just inspected it. Looks great. So
yes,
pay the check.
I would say yes, and I would say, I think I know what you're referring to, Bob, so
yeah.
I can't say.
Okay.
I believe that was a bit of an anomaly, and there was some accountability issues there with respect to the personnel that did it, and in fact, to the point of legal actions that are still ongoing on that particular case. So it's not a reason I don't necessarily want to speak about it.
Well, I'm just talking from a procedural standpoint.
Yes, sir.
I'm not getting into the case. I'm just moving on.
Yeah, and I mean, part of our audit too does look at that. You know, what's the process for approving the scope of the work? And the particular projects that we look at, we didn't see an indication that it wasn't properly approved or something that was paid for that wasn't, there was no services or work.
Yeah, of course, building, you 10 or 15 points at which you inspect what's going on, right?
Oh, much more than that. Yeah. We're required for what we call continuous inspection, and that's what our inspectors of record, who are licensed through the state, provide us, and it's literal continuous inspection. That doesn't mean that inspector necessarily is an expert at everything, but it is a generalist who can call a laboratory of record, who then sends out specialty inspectors to check the torque on the bolts, check the welds, x-ray them, even in many cases look at the rebar cages or reinforcing steel to see that that's been placed appropriately, take your concrete samples. I mean, it just goes on forever, and so there's a pretty tight quality control process. And is it perfect all the time? No, nothing's perfect. It's construction, unfortunately, but we do have a tremendous amount of inspection. We have to under the DSA.
I think it's interesting that we're with the change order. This is really helpful. I would take a step back. I've been involved with this since 2005 as a neighbor volunteer, and there's like this piece when you start the construction, start paying for it. But for me, the change order, the ridiculousness of the change order is before that. It's when you go forward with the project. This is where I think the waste comes in, and I don't think this is revealed in the audit. It's when a change order is made to appease a local political issue on campus as opposed to need. And so you end up with, you know, so-and-so needs their office over here, or they don't want windows, or, you know, whatever, the sun faces south. I think that is where there's a great deal of waste that's not being addressed, because the campus is, you know, I call myself a survivor, as a 6-7 years involved there, The local politics of that campus are causing all sorts of change orders to be approved for a number of political reasons that, to me, are a complete waste from the original project as it was designed, budgeted, sold into. And I would love to see that process, like a really strong, you don't get to change it unless there is an actual need.
Do we identify change orders?
Whatever.
For a classic change order or a scope change?
And what we do is we divide them into two categories because, David, just for the reason you said, we want to identify owners' requested scope changes, meaning they didn't hit a footing that they didn't know existed and it was not for a seen condition and it cost the doctor money because we had to bring in, you know, move the footing, do that. That's a legitimate change order. That's not for a seen condition. The idea behind differentiating in our board report. So when our board report goes to the board, they get to see the owner scope change requests. And there is a lot more scrutiny, I think, than what you've seen in the past, where they say, why are we changing out toilet fixtures at a cost of $156,000 when the job's already built? And well, the right answer is not because the college doesn't like wireless urinals. You know, what I'm saying is we're drawing attention to it through that so there can be scrutiny from the board to ensure that there's not any of these wasteful change orders or that people are asking for things that are not in the scope because they might have some extra money left over.
Which is a relatively new, over the last 18 months to 2 years, modification to the board agenda that goes to the Board of Trustees. It characterizes the change order by design package issue, which is analogous to an error and omission, unforeseen condition, or owner-directed change. And the last one is the one you're speaking
to. We categorize it as vanity. And I'd love it if we had some visibility to that from an audit perspective, because I know the board members spend 4 weeks preparing for each board meeting and read everything that's put in front of them. but that is a very important place, not to negate they work their ass off, but truth be told, that is one item in a very big bond project, $156,000 here and $200,000 there. Well, it's construction change, it's budgeted, it looks like it was approved by the campus president. CPM likes it, well, you know.
Yep.
But I think having experienced that, being on the bond oversight committee, I'm telling you, by the time it gets to the board, you know, all the politics have been laid off, but I think there's a huge amount of waste there, and I'd love to see it.
David, just to jump on that too, the BRP or the billing review panel that was commissioned last fall to look at our program, I also identify that as a concern.
Good. How do you distinguish between a frivolous change, political change of that kind, and a change which is made by a committee of the faculty and is grounded in very subjective terms?
Still a scope change, and somebody has to justify a scope change. I used to work for a development company that required the CEO to sign off scope changes.
Well, former job, I used to have to do that too. Anything requested by the owner
have to write a paragraph of why. The committee and the faculty of this department decided that if there were more sunlight in this room, students would be more attentive and education would be better served. What do you do with something like that?
It sounds as stupid as what you just said. No, I mean, but if you put it in writing, it does tend to start to sound either very valid or pretty stupid.
And I think that's a segue into our change order final. Still number two.
I was hoping to find that segue.
And really, what we're looking for is
let me just remind everybody, we're beginning to cut in the time we wanted for our construction review, which many people felt strongly about.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. So I think for us, there were several, I would say, smaller issues involving change order that led us to make a recommendation onto that, which is not uncommon, by the way. This program is by no means alone in that change order. Certainly a touchy topic, but I think the overriding theme there for us is we need to see more documentation. Because just like you said, why is this? Why are you doing this? What good does it do? So that's probably about to summarize that.
So that is your recommendation?
Yes.
And is that accommodatable?
Yes, in fact, it's not a process fault because the process is there that will give you the documentation. It's a performance fault at the case of typically at the campus level where they wouldn't provide the proper backup to a change order or a record of negotiation, something that we've seen. I don't want to sound too draconian in this, but we've had some repeat offenders, and those people given the replacements opportunity to fix it because they were unable to do it properly. So it's something we take very seriously. It was a repeat finding, if I'm not mistaken. So
yeah, there are really, different campuses, I must say. So
but
I think,
you have to have this documentation.
I can only raise it, Mr. Chairman, because part of it is the waste, fraud, and abuse.
It was a good point.
Even if it's justifiable, as that paragraph of the summary you said, that will get through a campus, and it'll get through all the way through the process, and the money will be spent, and it technically
and
is legal.
I agree with you, and I think that's because the philosophy of the organization is that the faculty has a strong input on the requirements. And if enough faculty, and they might, I try to make it a little silly, but on the other hand, I think it's conceivable that a change like that will get through the system. And while other people might think it's frivolous, it still may be in the values of the system, consistent with what's allowed.
And follow all processes. I mean, that's the kind of great fun here, is it'll follow all disclosures, it'll be documented, it'll be budgeted, there'll be change orders that are filed, records will be kept, but at the end of the day, it's IHS.
So let's,
well, but that's part of what we're doing.
It is. More than subjective, there's a set of values associated with it, which are academic values. Anyway, I'd like to segue into the conclusion.
Okay, so the conclusion, we do have some medium and lower priority items, which I think we can probably link to the report. The medium has to do with the closeout, which is, of course, a documentation issue, and we have one of our recommendations, too, is that currently the program does not have its own document retention policy as a district one, which is quite complicated, quite frankly. So we think, and that's something we've talked about, to make Institute One that's a little bit easier. And I think that coupled with now the more centralized oversight that's going to take place, I think it would be in pretty good shape.
So you're okay, the system is okay with that suggestion?
I think that there has to be you need a documentation standard that's basically across the district, and it's something we're definitely lacking, and that comes with the decentralization. If you look at a lot of the processes, in the way that everybody manages it, there's a lot of people managing it their own way, as opposed to having it done at a district level. I mean, there's still a lot of thought that these are nine colleges will manage it nine different ways, when you really need one core group that determines how things are going to be done, all the way down to a filing systems and protocols with respect.
Are we going to try to have this? This is probably a bad question. We're going to try to have all of our closeout documentation digital, or is it still going to be paper based?
A lot of it's paper-based, but that's a lot because of some of the agencies that we have to deal with. And the DSA and the lab reports need to be originals and some of those things. And quite frankly, I like to go, one of the things I like to do when I visit campuses and visit the trailers is ask to see their closeout files. And what I want to see is right from the beginning of that job, I want to see it populated before it even gets started. Closeout begins it before the job even starts. Because if you don't stay on it, if you don't manage it, and something else that the quality organization will be looking at is looking at the files that are supposed to be in there, you're going to spend 2 years chasing around lab reports that you're supposed to have, or tests that you were supposed to have, or something that was supposed to be signed. So it's extremely important that we start that in the jobs, and we push it down and enforce it.
Just one comment on that. While a lot of it is generated in a paper fashion, we do archive it electronically as a PDF in our document control system centrally. There's sometimes a lag between the completion of the process at the campus to when we can go out and scan and archive some of that. But we do keep an electronic PDF-based document control system.
That's what I was getting at. Eventually, that stuff, the paper stuff, seems to disappear. Somebody takes a copy of it and it never comes back.
But it is also not checked for completion. Is being accepted at face value right now what the CPMs does.
That's probably the CPM's one of responsibility to create that file, to manage and create that file and archive it and scan it in. There's not a redundant resource at the program level currently to double check the work of the CPM with regard to the archive package. But that may be something moving forward with the new authority and contract that can be put in place.
And that's something we'd be looking at with the new process, because what Jim is talking about is policing it as it's live, not after the fact.
That's right.
Hopeful that will result in then our audit next time being done.
And I hate to beat it to death, but that's another key performance indicator that you look at. Will be from the date of occupancy of a building until that CPM can get that job closed out. That tells you how well they documented that job and how ready and prepared they were to not only financially close it out, contractually close it out, and get it certified. So that's a key performance indicator that will be hanging on the wall for every one of those campuses. And we'll be able to see where our challenges lie and where the people are doing it correctly.
Do we have a standard-wide required warranty period, that sort of thing?
We used to, places I've worked, I would say we require a two-year warranty, and then at the end they slip in their standard 90 days. Do we have a standard, or do we accept what they do as normal
and
warranty?
I'll let Todd answer, because it might be outside of what I'm used to, because yeah, I'm typically used to the 12-month period, in which case at the 10-month portion, we send an IOR back out to check and do a review of the building to look for any outstanding warranty issues. Now, we have a very complex commissioning system here, which I believe they also manage a warranty program. Is that correct? You want to expand on that?
Todd, you're going to help us seamlessly transition to the next subject, which is construction. This is all very good.
Can I just say one more thing before we go? We had some low priority items. They're just a matter of consistency and policies. I do want to thank the build team, Jim, and the district for helping us. And we are going to begin our next audit in a month or two.
Sounds like a continuous process.
Ethel, you had a question?
Yeah, David raised an interesting point. In doing the performance audit of these specific colleges that you've decided on this year and that you're going to start with next year, I'm very aware that every college in the district has a particular style or culture, and I think this affects the way they operate towards the building problem. There are politics involved, there's faculty involved, and I'm wondering if some colleges are more efficient and more well-managed in terms of the building process than others, and whether, if this is so, we need to do some education, as it were, at the colleges that really don't give a darn about what's going on.
Yeah, and I think we can address that saying that we think, too, with some of these processes do need to be brought back and centralized. I think Jim is, as he used to say, heated agreement with that. And I think that's when you will see these discrepancies and some doing something better than others, because that's the way that they used to do it in the past or something like that. I think a lot is really driven by the individual CPMs and, of course, on the campus side.
That's what we suggested concretely, that part of their evaluation annually of the president was an examination of change orders. Because if you have a lot of change orders, it means the planning process to get your building was deficient. But then again, we've had six presidents since I've been at LA City College. So you have to ask yourself, as things turn over, how are you going to evaluate a president for a previous deficit in planning? We're in year 7 or 8 of the track and fields. You can't. But that was one concrete suggestion we came up with is, if you look president to president, some of them manage them very different. Like, well, I won't go into it, but presidents manage them differently, and you were able to actually have some accountability with the person who has to sign off at every campus, not just the CPM. CPM actually is one of them. The president is the ultimate where the buck stops.
Richard, you had comment?
Yeah.
That was a concrete way we suggested.
Richard was next.
At the last meeting, the resolution for the Board of Trustees dated September the 12th, that said standardized centralized accountability controls utilizing industry best practices for build LACCD. It was submitted to the Board of Trustees, I think. Have they signed off on it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And it was unsigned when it was presented to us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it was for our review, which we never got around to. But I think that addresses what you're talking about with all of these centralizing the accountability standards mandated by the Board of Trustees for the particular colleges, so that you don't have the colleges acting independently. As we tried to coordinate all of their monthly or their bi-monthly reports to us, and I don't think we've necessarily succeeded 100% yet, but it's getting closer.
But are you going to do an after-the-fact commentary on that matter, on that issue, on that motion? Mm-hmm. Well, 1 second, just asking the question about what you said.
No. Okay. Not until we've had a meeting.
Well, of course, but that's my point. You had to do that. Ethel.
Well, David has disappeared.
He'll be back. He just stepped out for a minute, I think.
Yeah, but I think off the record, you have to realize that the city is probably one of the worst. I worked on most of the campuses. I think the advantage of our having meetings on the different campuses with the different oversight committees may give us a better feel for how the campuses operate in terms of the responsibilities of these oversight committees for the building things.
Well, on that point, we had assigned an ad hoc committee to look into that question and to see what meetings could be scheduled. Unfortunately, it was led by Jayden, and he's no longer with us, so I don't think the Oversight Committee ever met. At the end of this meeting, somebody will remind me, I'll bring up that subject again.
Okay.
Give him, yes, I thank
him. Okay.
He wanted
us to leave, but I wouldn't.
Oh, okay. But you can, more than one of you saying that.
Maybe have the young lady saying, maybe have your name.
Sure, it's Erica Alvord. It should be on the
summary sheet.
Thank you
all very much.
And she is.
Thank you.
Tracy
Hansen.
They're signed works of art, but at least in print. Then we're all yours.
Very good.
By the way, just one comment. I just thought I'd make a note.
Yes, sir.
In the past, this information has been mailed in advance of the meeting.
Okay.
I didn't get any such package this time.
Okay.
And it's useful because we spent some time in advance trying to look at it, so we can reinstitute that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me make one other suggestion. That the next time we have a audit report that's going to be presented at the meeting, that we receive the audit report at home first.
Yes.
So that we, and a big note that says this is going to be reviewed at the next meeting, so you should read it.
Well, I did get the agenda for the meeting, so I knew it was going to be on there, but I didn't get most of the materials that I've gotten in the past.
That last time. We did
together
in advance.
Yes, but we're discussing it again because we're still not getting it. And we used to get them, you know, these big mail packages, not just construction, but other information.
Okay.
I didn't either.
I got stuff emailed. That's good feedback.
College reports, I got emailed.
I think that's addressed to the Deputy Chancellor.
I'm taking notes.
Thank you.
That's good feedback. And quickly, I just want to touch on what Richard said about the resolution that was passed last fall with regards to the centralization. That was all done in consideration of under the new program management structure, where we bring the accountability to, if you will, that one, you know, belly button to push when there's an issue, and hold that group accountable for the actions of the nine others. And that's where we have to really get into the metrics-based performance evaluation of each one of those firms out there, because we'll have to make some very, very tough decisions as to who's doing their job and who's not. And if they can't do their job, then we'll get somebody else the opportunity. Now, with that, we asked, or I was asked, to put together five of the outstanding, and I think five was a number that was
an arbitrary
number that we picked where I've got some real good bad news stories for us.
Oh.
And some real challenges that we're going through. Most of these are in litigation or some form of litigation. So when we wrote the brief, it's entitled Program Construction, District Citizens Oversight Committee Program Construction, Executive Director of Facilities Planning and Development. The idea here.
Not this.
No, sir.
Just a little bit.
Okay. No,
it's
two pages.
I'm sorry.
What are these?
These are our bad news stories.
Oh, bad news.
So I like to refer to them as our challenges right now. And it's not the only challenges we have in the program, mind you. But what we did is kind of go through what's the ones that really keep us awake at night at this point in time. Now, all of these are at a point where they have gone into some form of litigation or where we have engaged the assistance of attorneys. And in most cases, there's been forays back and forth. Some of them hopefully will end up with being good news stories, meaning we continue on with these and keep them moving. Others might get real ugly and hairy, but they are things that have to come to your attention. You need to be aware of some of these, and we'll keep you abreast of them at each meeting. And we might add to the list, but we'll keep you abreast of how these are progressing with respect to.
Yeah, I think these should be managed dynamically. If something new comes up that meets your category of seriousness, add it. If something is resolved, remove it.
Yeah.
And tell us along the way how it goes from being here to being resolved.
And what
tell us how it got resolved.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
that's what I just said.
And one of my goals when I arrived here was to try to, I'm sorry, Ann, but try to put the attorneys out of business, you know.
Good.
Cars. I know you do. And try to bring some of this stuff to what we consider business decisions. And a lot of that's through relationships. And a lot of it's through, I don't want to sound cheesy, but
A lot of it's through developing those relationships and some partnering at the front end of the projects, meaning you build a level of trust with some of the general contractors so that you can, that the president or the owner of that company can call me and has my direct line so that we don't just both sic our attorneys on each other and let them have it out and, you know, pay a bunch of attorney's bills 7 years down the road when the problem is resolved. I'm not saying that that's what occurred on any of these or that we could have saved them through any other ways. But that's just been always been my philosophy, and it's kept me out of court because I don't find court to be any fun. So with this, I'm going to let Todd, because Todd is an attorney, and he can speak to it without getting me in trouble or so I don't say anything that I'm not supposed to say, and update you and brief you on where we are on these five what we call, well, we'll figure out a good name for them. I would say challenging projects right now.
Opportunities. Anyway, English, not Latin.
But just one question. Can you put a dollar amount on each of these so we know what kind of money we're looking at?
We can. Some of them do have the dollar amount. Some of them aren't really monetary in nature. They're just they're just disputes. I have to say, because Jim said, I'm not an attorney in the state of mechanism program.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Maybe qualified. I said qualified.
He's a lawyer.
So I'll go through these in sequence. Again, as Jim indicated, all of these are under active current litigation. We've got the attorneys who is assigned to this blessing on these, this verbiage for public consumption, because we don't want to prejudice the district in any way or create liability with any of the statements that are in here. So
these are all public documents.
Yes. So another qualification. So the first item is Los Angeles Mission College Media Arts Center. The Media Arts Center out there, it's a state-funded project. It's mid-construction right now. And we've reported on this particular...
What does it mean to the state-funded project? That means it's outside of funding the bonds?
It's partially state-funded. So it has certain funding components that limits our delivery method choices, like we have to go low bid on state-funded projects, things like that.
So there's state money and bond money married together?
Correct. It's a reimbursement from the state for the capital work. More of a footnote than anything. The Media Arts Center, we reported on this before because what happened at the time, the surety for the contractor, SMC Construction was the original contractor, stepped forward after a default by that contractor and took over the project. So Hartford Insurance Company stepped forward, took over. There was a takeover agreement in January of 12, and they subsequently competed and brought on a new contractor, Kemp Construction. Who does a lot of surety takeover work. They proceeded to get started, dig in, start the work, and what was discovered subsequent to that was that there were defects in the structural steel connections. Right now it's a naked steel frame building with elevated concrete slabs and some of the internal framing in place, so it's mid progress. I'd say between 35 and 45% complete in the scheme of things, although that's a contested matter too. The connection discoveries were made subsequent to that takeover, and that pretty much brought the project to a halt because we couldn't move forward. Some were actually covered by fireproofing, so we had to remove the fireproofing, doing an analysis of what structural defects existed.
These are all welds?
They're bolting and welds. That's correct. It's a steel frame.
And I'm not sure. The company that went bankrupt is the company that did that. Or was it Hartford's new partner?
No, it was the original company. They defaulted. It wasn't a bankruptcy in this case, but they did default.
Aren't such joints checked prior to proceeding with the next phase of construction?
That's a
like
good
fireproofing.
Fireproofing and the connections by the welds are by specialty inspectors.
Right, right. We'll get there.
Yeah.
So it didn't happen in this case.
We'll get there.
It was
getting ahead of the story. Right? Yeah. So fat lady hasn't been cut.
So. Upon discovery of that, the cost for that really is borne by the surety. But obviously, they're going to take a position to shift responsibility in using arguments such as, hey, it's the inspector's fault. They're supposed to be looking at this. They let it go by. We took the position, which is commonly accepted and right in the contract, that quality control is the contractor's responsibility above all else. We don't, by inspecting, we're not taking over their quality control obligations.
You build quality if you don't inspect it, right?
Yeah. It's not an excuse. So... that disagreement led to the surety stopping work on the project because they saw their cash flow coming to a stop, basically, and saying, okay, we're going to be paying for remedial work, not earning any new funds, and you're going to backcharge us for liquidity delay and all these other things. So that's what caused the stoppage of work on the site. I know that it's right in the middle of campus. It's an issue for Mission College, and we've been doing everything we can to get that project moving again. There was a decision-making process on whether to continue a dialogue with the surety or whether to just say, thank you very much, we're going to sue you when we're done, continue with the surety. We did an analysis of where we would be left at the end of the day with both scenarios. And continuing a dialogue with the surety, keeping them on the hook, was the best plan A for the district. So we began that dialogue in October-ish, slightly before of 2012, end of last year. And we've gotten to a point now, it's not signed yet, but we've gotten to a place that's universally acceptable with a takeover agreement amendment, just to say about, you know, what the withholding, what the back charge is. It's basically mostly a reservation of rights where we're not admitting blame, the surety's not admitting blame, but we're coming to an agreement for them to move forward on the project, which in part includes them footing the bill for the remedial work for now. Not to say that we're not going to fight about it later, but for now, out of pocket, we're shifting that over to the surety. So that's good news from a budgeting and recovery standpoint. So it's an elaborate process. There's no shortage of lawyers. We're keeping them employed. But it's going to be best for the district moving forward. It's still a little tenuous. They still need to remobilize, expose the balance of those connections. We need to go back to DSA with a remedial package for fixing all those structural defect connections. And they need to approve it, and then they can run with the remediation of that project. So that's
Did
the current.
Does this group do other?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Is that Cracker Jack inspection? Do they do other wells, joints, the issue that's at stake here? Do they do other buildings?
The inspector of record?
Not the inspector. Well, the inspector should.
Surety.
Good question. But the
original contractor?
Whoever screwed up.
Yeah, the original contractor was working on another project for the district.
Have those been examined?
They defaulted on those projects too, and they were subsequently taken over by a new contractor. We didn't have
those wells or whatever been examined for surety.
It's an interesting question at LA Valley College, where it's the canopy project at Valley College. If anyone's familiar with it, our inspector in fact caught a problem with the welding there, which is shop welding, which was taking place in Texas on the steel tubes that are comprising it. We rejected those. We didn't accept the steel in that case because of the inspector identifying it. That ultimately led to a dispute and their default on that project. Their surety took it over. They had a new contractor come aboard, and they're well through the project at this point.
Jim, you know what I'm asking.
Yeah.
So my question is, and thank you for that thorough, but it's really simple. So if I found someone that screwed up my welds, I'd go back and inspect across the district any weld they ever did or whatever it is that's in question.
Yeah. So
even if they've been inspected, because clearly with fireproofing put above things, that means that they already skipped a step and were past as good. Does that make sense, just from a quality control?
Yes. Yeah. So the other project that they did was that one, and no steel went in place, and actually was the cause of the rejection of their work and default.
So the answer is yes, you are on top of that. You would have gone and revisited other things.
Other question is, you were kind of smiling when you talked about wells like this, which are structural wells, have to be certified by an independent inspector who is paid for separately to make sure that all the welding is done correctly. Do we have a problem with that inspector? Is he on the take? Is he incompetent? Is he not showing up?
Well, they were relieved of their duty, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, was the laboratory of record and the inspection company.
Because they're incompetent, or were they on the take?
Well, we don't have any evidence of kickbacks or anything of that nature. That inspector of record was immediately relieved of their duties. There's a strategic decision, and this happens with architects also, where you fight a two-front war, where you're litigating with the contractor saying, this is your responsibility, you know, you have to stand behind this, and concurrently going after and creating evidence for somebody else's responsibility for that. We're certainly reserving all rights and getting prepared for a discussion and the potential, you know, collection against the IOR and specialty inspection lab, but we're not fighting that battle right now. We have the evidence collated, and we have an attorney assigned to that.
Because we would basically build the case for the surety. They would claim, well, it was you guys didn't inspect us properly. It wasn't our fault, or it wasn't our.
My concern is different from liability, that sort of liability. My concern is, of all the things that you could cheat on in construction, welding is one that won't show up until we have an earthquake. If you cheat on the HVAC, pretty soon it's not going to be very cold in the room. If you cheat on, you know, windows, they leak. You start to get the quality problem. You may not see this until 15 years from now when we have the big one. We'll find out that these particular wells, and the reason we welded is because of seismic.
What I can assure you is on this particular program that there's been more attention or more detail paid to the welds and the connections in this steel than any other project probably in the district at this point. Obviously, we saw a little smoke, investigated, and then we found fire, and now we're going back to TSA with an entirely, with a fix-it plan, which will be very substantial.
Is there some sort of statewide licensing agency for this individual or company that was doing
this?
I mean, I go to my, everyone knows the Angie's List, right? I mean, can we get them removed from Angie's List? Is
it like, actually, their license.
We go after their license, we blacklist them. I mean, what do you do after the fact, maybe as you get through the project? But are we keeping, like, you're off my Hanukkah card list?
Yeah, actually, we've notified the Department of State Architects who license these particular inspectors. We've already notified them.
Right.
That's a legal duty at this point, is the process. Okay, I just want to say we got a half an hour and we got a 5-minute presentation at the end. So we do it here too. We didn't give you a fair shot. You started 10 minutes late, but we've got five projects. We're in the middle of the first one.
Oh, that was a good one, though.
Yeah, that's one, but the one thing I haven't heard, okay, generally is when you say you have a problem, there's a lot of reasons it can be serious. One of the reasons it could be serious is it's a safety problem. The building can fall down and blow it up. But generally, there's a notion of cost and schedule. As a consequence of this problem, what did it do to your plan, cost, and schedule for completion, your estimates at completion, for time and money?
I think right now we're reserving, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, we're reserving in our EAC, as I talked about, we account for risk as an additional $9 million to account for potential litigation and other associated fees and costs that might be associated with the $4 million. Talked about yesterday. We set aside.
So you've got a reserve of $9 million against the project that was supposed to cost?
Yeah, we actually, upon discovery of these items, the EAC increased.
Right, because that's what I'm asking. What would the EAC increase as a percentage of the project?
Tell everybody what that means.
The
estimate of completion. So we, you know, once you realize that there's a problem, you're going to spend more money to complete that project.
So I'm asking for the numbers.
Okay.
Was it a $10 million building and you now have a $9 million reserve?
The reserve added since the discovery of these items, I'm just speaking because we had a meeting on it this week. This isn't actual data. It's close to $4 to $5 million.
And what percentage of the original estimate to complete is that?
It's approximately an additional 10%.
Okay.
And that we've accounted for. We think is generous and should cover for the risk.
And is there any significance to the fact that as a result of what's going on? Okay, the building is going to be completed. Schedule has to have changed.
Yes.
The building is going to be later than originally scheduled.
Yes, that's correct.
Is there something significant there?
Yes.
And what is that? Does that mean like students are going to miss a semester that they otherwise would not have?
It would be a continuation in either transitory swing space for the existing programs. I don't know of any programs that were canceled or currently scheduled for the occupancy of that building that had to be deferred. It would just be a continuation in the current facilities for the period longer.
Doesn't it make it later in time when the building can be used?
Yes.
And isn't there any significance to that, just the time aspect of it?
There's significance in, at this point, the responsible party for the delay's liability. In our opinion, it's the surety. So there's a per day penalty.
Well, no, I understand. I'm asking you a different question. Okay, I'm building a house. I want to move in February. And I suddenly find out it isn't going to be available to June. That's a major.
Right. As I said, if you were in temporary space, if you were renting an apartment during that period,
that
would have to be continued. I do believe there's a subset of the programs that are ending up in that building that are in a temporary facility. Whether it's rented or not, I don't believe that there's any rented space.
Or Elliot, they may be in another building right now, and they're just going to continue to stay in that other building.
All these things are true. I want to know what's true in the case of this building. Is it the case that some people are just going to stay in another building for a longer period of time that was going to be demolished anyway? Or is it a case that in one semester, the student population will be decreased because this building isn't available?
No, the programs will continue in another space. In many of these cases, Elliot, we have rental spaces that we use. So the costs that are incurred for those rentals will be tacked back onto that surety's bill, so they're going to pay.
Yeah. And again, if there's specific questions, you know, we couldn't prepare for every intricacy such as swing space, but we can report back with any information that you might need.
But I don't do it. I've talked too much. Please proceed.
So I do assume the $10 million will be recaptured through some litigation of some kind or agreement with the surety and whomever.
Currently, the dollar amount is not yet realized as a cost.
Well, whatever the number is.
Right.
There's going to be an overrun.
The intent is to pursue the responsible parties, maybe the surety or another party.
Pursue absolutely. All costs.
Yeah. Okay. We're learning all of us, please.
Okay. I'm on page 2, item 2. This is Los Angeles Southwest College School of Math and Science. This is a building that was at one point called the Lecture Lab Building. If you go to Southwest College, it's currently exposed in its decks and framing right now. That was a renovation project of a building that was constructed in the mid-90s. And Hansel Phelps is a contractor. They were tasked with removing the skin of that building and beginning the renovation. The skin removal was associated with a water intrusion issue in the outside envelope of the building. So it had nothing to do with inside occupancy, airspace, or anything like that. It was out in the skin area. That removal revealed conditions that weren't compliant with the original DSA documents. So when it was built in the mid-90s, which is before all the bonds, it was a state-funded project from a different origin. It was not constructed according to some of the details of the exterior framing, which isn't necessarily structural holding up the building itself, but it holds up the curtain wall and holds up some of the features on the exterior skin of the building. So there's different details for connecting a steel stud to a plate. Those were non-compliant and pretty common when it was exposed. So we're in the process now of fully evaluating that, preparing that Hansel Phelps, the design builder, is preparing a package to go to DSA for the remediation of those defects. So we have yet to fully understand the scope of those repairs, what DSA will accept, and the schedule and cost impact of that. So we're in a transitionary period right now, but we've discovered it, we've identified it, and it's going down the road of a resolution. What it will prompt is a structural upgrade of the building in most likelihood to the current code, which is a big difference from the mid-90s. So there will be a cost associated with that. We're trying to come up with the least, the most efficient, but obviously compliant solution to that.
So we have to pay for that?
We have to pay for that. Again, we have counsel assigned to this who's reviewed our ability to collect against the original contractor, inspector, or the teams that were involved at that
time. That goes back
that's
to
an issue.
Yeah.
Wow. That goes back to mid-90s.
And wasn't that inspected? I mean, this is my concern. We talked earlier about these, you know, rapid fire inspections, but we keep talking about things that are uncovered.
This one went back to the mid-90s. Yeah, but the good news we have on this particular project, at least for me, it helps me, is Hensel Phelps is one of the premier contractors in the entire country. They're very good and they're very capable. They run into problems, they're customer-centric, they're not afraid to bring really good solutions, and their quality control is amongst the very best.
Those are the ones that are fixing it.
Yes.
But the other folks, you know, Contractor A, are they employed by us? Did we report them to this? Is there any follow-up? I know legal maybe, but...
That was actually before the whole bond program began.
I understand that, but let's just say that company is still a business and is doing work at Southwest.
Who was it?
Or, I do know, but we talk about it or not?
That's my question is, are we employing them again? You know, can we double down those inspections? Have we reported the mishap we've uncovered to the proper authorities? I mean, they've understructured a building.
I'd be hesitant to include anything that's not in this far as the identity.
I don't want to know who they are. I'm not asking that. My question is, I mean, let me just reiterate it. It's yes or no answers. We know who they are. Have we reported them to the proper authorities?
No. We have not gotten, there's more to the yes or no.
We will.
Well, we have to find out the responsible.
It doesn't matter. Yeah,
there's a big time test.
So we have an expert structural engineer reviewing what the actual causation was and looking back at DSA's archived documents about whether or not there was the adequate inspection, who those inspectors were.
That one's on my first question, though. Because my concern is we're not reporting it, and like, we're not helping the statewide industry by not. And it sounds like it might happen. My point is, yes. Fix all the things, do all that, but like if we keep just letting this industry
being chock full of people who get by and 20 years later their defects are uncovered, we're going to end up hiring them, or LAUSD's going
to
end up hiring them.
I don't want to be hyperbolic about our approach to those things, but we have to be careful about slander.
Yes.
We have to get to the bottom of the factual question before we put out a contractor's name as creating defective
work. This could be a completely engineered defect that the engineer, they developed it, the DSA approved it, and the contractor installed it.
At the end of the day, we're having to fix something that is wrong, that wasn't compliant with the set of documents that are with DSA.
At the end of the day,
we can establish responsibility.
What's that?
Yeah.
There's just a lot of investment. We're just getting there.
This sounds to me like you're asking a lot of questions that they still need to do a lot of research.
Exactly.
And the problem with anything that goes back to the mid-90s.
I would like to be brief on this. We discussed this in detail, and just what you said, the codes have changed since the mid-90s, and then all of a sudden, the people in the room, the committee, they were afraid of lawyers and we need to face up. Why are we so afraid of the lawyers when we can prove that something is wrong with the building? They're afraid of litigation and whatever.
Because we can't prove whose fault it is right now. Okay. And I'm sorry, this is an attorney.
I just want to mention, I know you guys mentioned the possibility of a libel slander, but also under the public contract code, there's a specific legal process to debar the disqualified contractors because you are depriving them of a property interest. So it's not as easy as just saying, they did this, and we need to report them. There's an entire legal process involved with attorneys sometimes who are involved that represent the contractor. So probably be good if we kind of wrapped up this discussion so we don't have this discussion of another.
I think it would be a good practice, not speaking counter to what you just said, but it would be a good practice if you discuss one of these things and we say, there are some things we don't know, and we therefore can't reveal what we do not know. We're just giving you the status of what we consider to be a bad problem.
But I think that we can say, and Jim and Tom, who are in the room, can say that in those instances when we know and can for sure say that there is a problem and we can identify the source of the problem, the district has been very aggressive about seeking the kind of recourse that you're talking about. So it's not like we're just sitting back not doing anything. We have. It's just a process, as Ann said, that takes time. But we have been very aggressive in that regard.
We have debarred. This district has debarred contractors in recent past, having to do with safety issues and quality issues and labor compliance issues well in advance of other public agencies. It's an expensive process. It's there's risks to the process, but compared to some other public agencies, this district has been very aggressive with debarment. And in many cases, very
well, just one point, and this is to support this kind of, I call it a new approach. I like this, is I don't think we want to discourage them from coming up. This will be a multi-meeting process where you'll say, this is where we are now, here's what it is, stop that conversation, you'll follow up later, and then we can answer some of the other
questions. Yeah, I think that's really important, otherwise we're going to start burning the message.
Yeah, we'll just kill a lot of time.
Construction litigation, construction issues can last, I mean, a small case can last 7 to 10 years in some cases, so, we'll brief you as we get updates.
Let's go on to the phone, Rick, 3.
Yes. Item 3 is regarding the Child Development Center at LA Trade Tech College, which was completed a few years ago, I think it was 2008. There was two components to the dispute on this. One is complete, one is still outstanding. The first part had to do with scope and disagreements with the original contractor as to entitlement to compensation for work in place. That's ultimately has been resolved by an arbitration. The matter that's still outstanding has to do with the water intrusion issue and certain details on the building envelope. That's proceeding towards arbitration right now with the construction arbitrator that are put in place. They have experience in construction. You don't have to spend a lot of money educating them on construction. They're already educated on it. So that's pretty much that relatively straightforward construction detail issue.
In fact, if there was an issue with the scope, does that mean that the contract would have been written better?
It had to do with the plans and specifications with regard to a certain.
No, was it a case where two
absolutely honest and willing to cooperate parties could read something differently because it wasn't sufficiently spelled out?
The lawyer in me says that's a leading question, but that's what it appeared to be in my judgment.
Okay, so there's an area of improvement, perhaps. Lesson learned for future contracts.
Process. Yeah, and the contract itself dated back to, as you see, 2005. So that's an example of the vintage in some of the...
You guys are getting a lot of concrete boots put on you. So with the defect in this case, the water penetration, was it traced to something, and was that something inspected? And have we followed up with that inspector? Or whatever the leak was, or whatever this water penetration, I'm just making it up that it's a window and a leak. Did we follow up? Was there a defect of some sort that led to that?
There was a defect. As to the responsible party, whether it was a design issue or a contractor issue, that's really in the heart of what's about to go to arbitration.
So chill out. We'll get back to you. Great.
I'd hesitate to go back to the lawyer's group.
Moving on.
So just one question. You immediately mitigate a problem like that and then go back later and look for some sort of a judgment to make up for the cost of mitigation?
Yes.
We'd certainly fix something like that as an emergency case because, and then seek restitution later because obviously you can't have the water dripping in because
exactly. Next item. This
number
is
four now, right?
Number four. Yeah. I'm still on page two, leading on to page three. This is the E1G1 entry plaza project at East LA College.
UCLA?
East Los Angeles College. So this project, and again, this one is it's on appeal right now. It's been remanded back to the arbitrator. So a dispute existed having to do on the contractors, from the contractors' argument, the amount they were entitled after termination in 2009, I apologize, April. At the termination of that, their contest was that they were entitled to more money than the district actually paid them for the work in place because it was terminated mid-construction. The project was behind its established schedule and it wasn't making progress, so the district terminated. The district had an affirmative claim as to defects, and it went to an arbitration, and a result occurred in the arbitration. And let's see if they decide to. Yes, they indicated it's an $8.6 million judgment in favor of the contractor. But if you think about the continuum, the contractor was asking for something nearly twice that. The district was asking for a recompense probably closer to six or seven. So this is somewhat of a split the baby result by the arbitrator. The district looked at it, our counsel looked at it, appealed to the courts, and went from private arbitrator to court to say, hey, this guy messed up this part of a calculation. Let's revisit that. That occurred, the court agreed with the points that our counsel made and remanded it back to the arbitrator. So it's going back to the arbitrator to revisit things like interest calculations and things like that.
So we're hoping to gain some money out of that one, this one. I said we're hoping to gain some money out of that one.
We're hoping
to. You're not going to come out net positive, though. It's just less negative.
Correct. The last item on this page has to do with the East LA Performing and Fine Arts Center East LA College. The current dispute exists. It's almost similar to the other one. The contractor is asserting that they're owed more money for changes to the work and delay, district caused delay. And the district has a water intrusion backyard currently against the retention for the contractor. So we've withheld what we think is the fair value from their retention for the repair of this building envelope issue. And they've made a claim to say, hey, give us that money and give us more money for retention. So we're in the data gathering portion of some of the water intrusion issues, as well as creating a case against their claim.
Under our contract, do the contractors have to submit scheduled delay claims as they occur?
They have to notify us if we cause them a delay within, what is it, 30 days or 2 weeks or what's
I think it's a 14 days it's going to be a claim. But they owe us a baseline scheduled opinion project and monthly updates with every pay application. And then when they submit a delay claim, they have to submit what's called a fragment analysis of how something that happened hit their critical path, hit their long pole of intent for their schedule to justify it.
That's good defense. Just be you, Richard, didn't return my phone call.
That's right.
The groups I report to were really pleased with this, so thank you for this, okay. Because they could see it.
Well, we'll get it out to you in advance.
Okay, this is very good. Thank you.
Todd, good job. These had to do with construction that have some financial connection. Were there any financial, monetary misallocations using funds in the wrong programs for the wrong things? Any of that happened that we should know about? Am I making sense? Since our job is to watch the money and make sure it's used correctly, I'm interested in also just the pure money. Has there been any monetary shifting or misallocations of funds into the wrong programs or anything like that? That we should know about?
You mean from the contractor's point of view?
No, just for us.
For us?
As a construction, have you seen any monetary problems that or misallocation of funds? Or I don't know if I'm using all the right terms.
I think we've had some debates, and I think the debate is going to continue, and I think ultimately we will probably come to agree to disagree with the state controller's office. And this has to do with the use of what we call color of money of the three different bonds, the AAA and J monies. Our bond attorney, we have bond counsel that we hire, who represents, I believe, 62 of the 72 community college districts in the state, is fully behind us and saying that we're okay with how we're spending the money, and if we're the project's listed, we can spend the bond money on this. There was an SEO report, was it about a year ago that came out?
11?
Was it 11? That disagreed with that, with the opinion said, no, in fact, you have to spend it this way. And if I'm not mistaken, did we defer that to the Attorney General or something?
Isn't that the one that Heather said that because we called something a student center and later changed it to a campus commons, that it wasn't considered bond money?
That's it.
Correct.
That's it.
It had all to do with like semantics.
That's it.
My humble opinion as an attorney.
And Bob, is that like?
Yeah. Is that a big number?
I don't know.
50 million? 10 million?
Go. You can talk about it. I'm sorry. Okay.
There's nothing that we've ever found where we spent the wrong money or haven't done anything within the right ballot that attorneys have not approved and the auditors have not approved.
Okay. And just for your information, Mona is the one who keeps it straight on all that. For the campuses who spend money, they have to ask her if this is the right money to spend on these projects.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the reason for the problem area. Is there anything monetary?
I could find every one of these five projects, could I not, is the question.
Yeah.
On the sheet.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you would be able to tell me, by looking at the sheet, what the schedule impact and what the cost impact of these problems are, or maybe they're nestled in a bunch of other problems.
I think to be specific, I don't know that we could be specific on any of these.
Because this reflects, any one of these things reflects some of many issues that are being dealt with, and this is one specific within the many?
Yeah. In the rough orders of magnitude, oftentimes on what we think are exposed to, but we want to reflect it, as we said, the EAC, so we never overcommit monies. So we put in what we believe is fair and reasonable numbers.
Sure.
And we've actually forced the campuses to do that, to reflect some of these exposures, as well as, in some cases, we can't necessarily, we can give you a swag.
Swag would be worthwhile.
Well, I mean, not on the schedule. I'm saying on the schedule, for instance, that
whatever you're comfortable with, that gives us something that's metrizable, it's a number,
sure,
would be helpful. The other thing, I can assure you that I think I'm going to do this and several others are going to do this, is when we get these in advance, and I guess they can't be more earlier than 72 hours in advance. Right. So we have 3 days to look at this, and I'm going to look at this, and I think other people will too. And if there's something that appears to be bulging or important to us,
sure,
bring it up during the session. But I think we've all learned from this. Mm-hmm. I think it's very good. I had no idea, that the emphasis would be as legal as it has been, because in the businesses that I've been, you have contracts, you have to fulfill them. It isn't a question of suing one another. It's a question of fulfilling the contract, which is a different set of circumstances in the speech. David,
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks to all. No, I just have one thing.
Bob, of the meeting, but this is the last thing you're going to say. I just want to point that out.
Boy, I've got limits.
Yourself.
There's two questions in a row. Are there things that you did not mention that are pre-litigation that we could learn from that are not here? And if so, maybe you think about that for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Okay? Because that would be good to know, too. And lastly, you didn't talk about anything to brag about. Remember, this is supposed to be good news, bad news?
I think the braggingness was inherent in the diligence of the thing.
Well, I think so, but
and the planning of that report.
You know what?
We had 4 years of that to begin with. This is balancing
out.
Well, you know what? We did prepare some wins, but I know we don't have time for them. We prepared five big, what we call victories, and these are the top challenges. But we knew that you were interested in hearing some of the you want to see how the sausage was made on some of this stuff.
This is the problem list. That's what we asked for. That's not true.
But we do have victory.
Good stories are admissible. Also, we've been trying to get on three board meetings now.
Yes, I have. So three things. Well, one project that I was involved with and have since kind of obviously taken a step back is the student union at LA City College. So I sent my list of concerns and I sent photos of them. A couple of things I'll talk about and you can maybe address them. One is the extensive cracking, not just in the building exterior, but all the different types of concrete, including the polished concrete floors, the staircase, the exterior. There's many different types of concrete on the exterior. I saw patching going up, but what I'm concerned about is patching. So I patch my stucco a lot. You know what happens in a couple of years of my home? I repatch my stucco. So I'm concerned about, A, why is there so much cracking that's just completed? I don't want to hear about ash, but it seems to me that there shouldn't be that level of cracking in all the types of concrete that are there, that there's something wrong. And then, two, my concern in the building is, and I was part of the team that was the user group, is we budgeted for glass in the building. The project went forward to the board with glass in the building. I've never seen a change order. And by glass, I mean in the stairwell, there was glass instead of, you know, when you walk upstairs, there's something between death on the, when you falling over, and the stairs, usually it's balustrades or something. Yeah. There's some sort of netting, which
stainless steel.
It's just inviting someone to climb it or a kid to get cut if you run your hand against it, as I've done. It is just, and it looks terrible. So the project, as we've laid out, because I was very much on top of this, included, and it was never changed, a significant change, that netting. And there's, I just think it's a terrible change that occurred. And finally, my concern in that building, which, and I think it's a gorgeous building, by the way, I'm picking on the things that are wrong with it, but I think it's beautiful. Has to do with the retail. And the reason I think it's the purview of this group is because we built that building with retail, and we spent a lot of money on it, and it's walled off. And what I'm concerned about, they were going to put in three food court venues and a coffee shop.
Yep.
What I'm concerned about is, and it's not a construction issue, but it's related to the expenditure bond funds, is we put out an RFP for the retail vendors. We pulled it back, made changes, which I think are beyond the scope of what you're allowed to do in that situation when requests and responses came in. And it's been reissued. It's not been reissued. I'm not sure. But we have three boarded up venues when we knew that building was going up with retail for the last 5 years. So I'm concerned that there's been a waste and continues to be a lack of return on what this committee has oversight to. So let me just reiterate, concrete cracking.
All right, let me take that first.
The wire mesh and the retail.
Let's do with concrete. What we've done is we've had the American Society, the American Institute of Concrete. Anyways, the Concrete Institute had come out and looked at it and determined that it was within the standards of concrete. Now, that being said, we also realize that in some cases, on the exterior, what you concern yourselves with is water migration or water intrusion past the topping slabs. And this was not a monolithic pour, right? This was a pour with a topping slab on top of it.
Is this all horizontal concrete?
No, it's all surface.
What he's talking about is horizontal concrete. And so what they're doing, it's not just like slapping a little dap on the wall or patching a stucco. It's an epoxy gravity injection. So what it is you put epoxy into these cracks to make sure that there's no water intrusion, that nothing can come through. Now, I've had more than I care to mention experience with stained concrete floors and concrete floors. And you can argue all day with the architects about the cracks of it, and they will tell you that that's the beauty of the stained concrete and the polished concrete, and that that's just fabulous. That's what they always wanted. I bought that one before, and that's what I always heard. But as I said, we did have a standards group out there, a concrete, and they, this has been progressive. This has been a constant issue since you brought it up the first time, and since actually I went out there for a meeting and looked at it myself. And they've been working on it. So you may want to get an update from your CPM as to what's happened in the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks. As far as the mesh is concerned, on
just on the concrete.
Yeah.
I went out there. I used to represent construction.
Sure.
Not companies, but mixed-use developments. So I went out there with a friend of mine who's currently building some towers in Los Angeles. And he was shocked at the amount of cracking that he saw. Shocked. And this guy is very boring Midwest. Shocked. Because I thought I was crazy. I was told I was being a little exaggeration. It's not just one surface or one pour of concrete. It's the diamond-shaped patterns on the exterior patio, crack right down the middle. The stairs, different pour, cracked extensively. The large outdoor staircase. The vertical planes between the track and field, different pour entirely, cracked extensively. So to me, yes, I get it. Polished concrete floors will crack. I have them in my home, they crack. That's not the issue. The issue is everywhere I look in this building, it's chock full of cracks. And if you bought a new car and all of a sudden you're like, oh crap, it's scratched everywhere. Let me just marker over that with a different color thing. You're buying a new product and all I see are just tremendous. And I encourage all the board here to look at this building, to go visit it. I did share photos, not to belabor the point, Elliot. I am very concerned about this building, and I think there's something deeper wrong here that needs to be investigated. And I'm not comfortable with just the epoxy fix.
Well, that's which building is it?
The LACC Student Union.
That's why we had the American Concrete Institute to take a look at it, just to see if it was beyond the standard of care. Of course, they're going to defend concrete, so I don't know if they're the most objective group, but. It hasn't stopped as far as what we're doing in regards to an investigation. There was also, you heard the fly ash case, and there's a lot of different things.
Is there somebody from ASTM
that we could get that would make a standard judgment on that?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
It's something we could certainly
look at. Crashing from it's a very common problem, but it.
I've not noticed it in any other buildings, but I go
to. Well, poor concrete.
Yeah.
Especially in today's
My point is that the other buildings on campus do not have this level of crack. So that I love everyone keep saying concrete crack. I get that. My point is when I go around the district and I tour buildings, I have been to a lot of your campuses, they're not this extensively cracked. I think there's something wrong there.
I don't want to be a lawyer here, but my guess is unless we can get somebody really independent, who is considered the god / czar of this sort of thing, to say that it's wrong, we're either going to have to suck it up or spend a lot of money, which we don't have, to remediate.
Problem is, you can get a star from both sides.
I understand.
But wouldn't there be expansion joints in there?
Yeah,
to help the gate.
There's joints in there. A lot of what you're seeing is it's surface cracking. It's on
checking.
It's
some people call it.
Yeah.
It's hard to do really good expansion joints. That's why I asked if it was horizontal. In interior floors where you want that beautiful polished concrete look, because the expansion joints get ugly. So you do minimal little or saw cuts or something like that. But they're really hard to do well.
I'm sorry. Just touch base in the LACCD ASU building. My name is Daniel Campos. I'm the student trustee. I'm sitting right now, hopefully, like the student representative. And I talked to the president. I don't know if this is in the right place to say this, but I heard from the students also a couple complaints about they have changed their name to the ASG now. And I know the building is called the ASU and City College. Johns being the president. So is there any considerations to changing that building back to ASG now instead of having
the
ASU?
What's the significance of changing the name?
What does the ASG stand for?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
What does that new name stand for?
Associated Student Government.
And the original name was?
As Associated Student Union.
You know, Jamie, well,
the Transportation Services Center?
Wait, is this even in our purview here?
That's what I asked, and I wanted to know if this was the right...
That structure, that's legitimate.
No?
So what's the path forward on this?
Path forward is still under investigation.
Can I ask one thing? Where is this building? This isn't the services center. This is... And when was it completed? Just recently. But it's not on that larger schedule.
Because it's done. David, may I jump to your...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Excuse me. Will everybody agree to... I'll take a vote on extending this meeting 10 minutes or 2 o'clock. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Let's go. 10 minutes.
On your question about the food court, there was no real issuance of this RFP. The RFP was issued in the summer of last year, and the evaluative process has been ongoing. The committee has not provided a formal
inconsistent with what I understand, but I don't want to belabor the point, and okay, we'll follow up accordingly.
What committee?
There was an evaluation panel currently on that procurement for that space.
A year after the RFP.
But once again, would that even be in our purview?
It is. It's waste. We built a building with 3 retail vendors. It was built in this idea of kind of creating an economic model, bringing support to the ASO, ASG, or AS something, as well as the campus, and it's been sitting there. They actually walled them off. So to me, that's waste of bond money.
So again, the status of the first thing cracking is it's still being investigated. The solution is still being considered.
Well, they're performing the solution on some of it, I think mostly on the horizontal concrete. I don't think you're going to see any change on any of the flat polish stuff. As you know, that's usually part of the coolness of it. On the stuff outside,
steel mesh.
I don't believe it's structural. We're just still doing the gravity fed epoxy injection for those fixes. And then I noticed a couple cracks in the vertical column that I wanted to look at. So as I said, we had one standard instead of two, but they were from concrete standard. And it doesn't mean that we stopped there. And you might want to, and I've asked actually somebody from the CPM to get in touch with you. Did he get in touch with you? Did he tell you it's still moving? And
he
still
did,
moving?
But I think this body needs to hear it because I've been talking about it before you were here, before I was on this board.
Okay.
I just want to go farther on what you're talking about. It may or may not. It's a fine line whether this committee would have anything to say about that. If the project was built, completed, as originally projected by the bond fund, and then the district's responsibility is to decide what uses those facilities are going to be put at, whether this committee at that point, once that project is finished, has any say-so whatsoever is very technical. The Van de Kamp group that was opposed to the uses that were utilized for the Van de Kamp bakery site continually came to these meetings and attempted to get this committee to take a position on that, and we never did. And the reason we didn't was because we didn't feel that it was part of our purview. At least that was my thought. I don't know that we ever took a committee-wide vote on whether or not we should enter into that discussion or not.
I don't want to get into Van de Kamp, but I would respectfully disagree that we have paid for, out of bond funding, 3 conceived of retail venues,
right,
that in the expenditure the building was contemplated would bring in revenue to the campus.
Right.
The building is not permanently signed off. There continues to be construction, and there's been no action, and those retail spaces remain empty. It's at least a question. We don't necessarily have to take a position, but we could always err on the side of bringing an issue like that up.
Well, I think you heard there has been action. It's just not done.
I agree.
You know,
so David, there has been action on it. We're working on the process. We've still got an active RFP on the street. We can't really comment about that RFP right now. There are several people that have interest in competing on that process. You know, so it's not appropriate to comment on that.
It's still talking about cracking, right?
No,
we're talking about the retail space.
It was a board directive to put it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
We need the
wire mesh issue addressed.
Exactly.
It's the remaining issue, the wire mesh issue.
Was that value engineering?
I wouldn't be able to tell you. I think wire mesh is kind of cool, but that's...
But was it...
Who wants wire mesh in their home? on their staircase.
I would totally. I think it looks awesome. And it's
fishnet
cool.
Wire mesh.
It's not. Looks. It looks more like chicken wire, and it's really cool.
Chicken wire, thank you.
This sounds to me...
That seems like a stylistic choice.
Well, no, it was in the programming documents to include glass.
Which is wildly expensive. My guess is that this was probably value engineered. Is there a process that we go through when we value engineer a building to let the various stakeholders know, or do we care? I mean, value engineering oftentimes gets rid of bells and whistles and flourishes that a lot of people like. How is that reviewed, or is it not?
But, you know, in the scheme of, like, the definition of value engineering, doesn't change the use of the substance. It's just a more efficient way of delivering the same product. That's really a scope reduction. So that would be an owner-directed change in that case, where you're changing from some substance to another, some functionality to another. It would be ultimately captured in a change order if it's a modification to scope of price.
Can we find that change order?
You did mention that.
Then I find the next meeting or look into it.
I don't know the answer to that as far as the rules.
Here's my concern. I had this in the library as well before I was on this board. We had one set of things for the staircase that became something else, which were ultimately in the library, MLK library, pulled out because they were non-functional. Same thing in the elevator flooring. It sounds minor, but there's these changes occurring when you go through this process as a user group, which let me tell you how much fun that is, that have significant impacts, both visually. So I bring in donors, right, when I was a foundation director at LA City College. There's chicken wire on the staircase. There's cracking all over the building that's being epoxied. And although structurally it may be sound, how does that, are you buying a used car just because it has a scratch on the side of it and it's brand new? It matters. So these little things to me, the detail is what I expect my money to be spent with and the attention I bring to it. So when I see chicken
you're looking
wire.
At me and I just want to be clear that I'm not.
So when I see
about
that. So when I give me a definition, I was talking about the floor. And I agree on the retail with you. It's a question. But when I look at these things like the chicken wire being changed or the wire mesh, it's concerning to me because there is a process that we go through to pick those things. People weigh in. Things were sacrificed to make the glass. To your point, it was expensive, but there was a perception by the ASO president that this was the Regal building, the signature building of the signature campus. No offense, to the district, and this was worth the investment. So we cut on other things, projection, LED TVs, no arc lighting in the hallways, no integrated trash cans, stainless steel stall doors went out the way for pressed cardboard, and the glass was kept. So when you get to the point when I come back to this building and I'm seeing cracks that are being epoxied, that look horrendous, and wire mesh, my thinking to myself is, what is going on here? And is there a bigger issue? That's why I'm interested in these questions.
I think your glazing took you another 3 months to get the glazing, or you had your option of putting in the cool-looking stainless steel wire mesh. That's probably something that happened at the campus level. I don't know the answer to it right now. It's a very, very particular thing. And I would ask, and, you know, this is obviously the purview of the committee. Okay, so, but, I mean, if we get into if this committee is going to be dedicated to everybody, all nine campuses bringing 10 to 20 minute issues on a certain building, and we might as well form another punch list related committee, because I think we're going to end up taking all the time. I don't know.
Topic hasn't ignited anything, you know, spectacular. No fault of the presenter.
I'll follow up with DPM.
Please, we have one other topic to discuss. I was reminded of that we put off to this point, and that is how we go about arranging for a rotating visit every other meeting to the various campuses. Again, that was assigned to an ad hoc committee. Does anybody want to look into that to see what the likelihood is, what difficulties and easy points are, how we could, would you like to do that?
No, I have no volunteer.
What happens when you raise your hand?
I just wanted to say, I brought it up at Pierce College at our meeting, and the president and I were sitting over there, and said, oh, that's great.
Do we need a committee, or do we just need to find out from the staff of LA Community College District?
You can decide where you want to meet, when you want to meet.
Yeah, I think we ought to pick a rotation.
Someone volunteer at our college.
She just did.
Looks like the next meeting's at Paris.
I was going to suggest the first one would be City Cup.
Oh, you can see the situation.
You look at the chicken wire.
There we go.
We've done Trace Tech.
No, but City College is a good one because of these issues. So does anybody have a strong objection that we go about arranging the next visit at City College?
Sounds good.
Or we're going to do it.
Or are we going to separate tour and still have a meeting at Paris?
Yes, that's why these two guys need to see my drive.
LACC.
I mean, we can do a Paris after. But they already said.
Guys, if you can't come to a conclusion on simple subjects like this and a meeting like this.
I'd like to make a motion the next meeting be held at City College.
Second, David Ambrose.
Discussion. Well, take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
There it is.
Can I
make the arrangements or do you have a chance to make the arrangements?
Would this meeting be along with the City College Oversight Committee?
No.
Our own meeting.
No.
Our own meeting.
Because then we'll get into what he said, which is you'll learn all about our minutia.
I need to get dates for the next year, so I will set some dates.
But we have a date for the next meeting.
I know. Okay, next meeting, but then we run out of days pretty quick. So we want to be able to get those out to you. So we'll get the dates, and then you guys can discuss them at the next meeting.
Very good. Thank you. What is the next meeting?
I think you're going to have problems if the campus oversight committee finds out that we're jumping on over them.
At the week, we have a separate responsibility. If we have problems, we'll learn from those. But we're entirely within our jurisdiction to do what
we're
doing.
Yes, you can.
Kelly?
Yeah.
One other thing I just wanted to make note that we need an ad hoc committee meeting on three issues that were held over from the last meeting. One was the resolution of the Board of Trustees on the satellite and district bond contingency fund. The other was the standardized centralization accountability.
So these are the three motions, the Board of Trustees.
And the third was a review of the differences between design build and design bid build that the district officers were going to provide us at an ad hoc committee.
And those who are willing to work with Richard on that, so you'll know who they are?
Well, we know who they are. Okay. From the last time.
Right.
So we'll ask the same people that volunteered before to participate. And also, we'll try for a meeting sometime in April.
Thank you.
Okay.
So and you'll coordinate that.
The next PCOC meeting is on the 26th.
Right.
April.
Are we motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
I can take me a beer, okay?